Good afternoon. My name is Emanuela Sala, and I'd like to welcome you, also on behalf of Annette Jekyll and Florian Koisch, to this podcast on data linkage and sharing. So we'll discuss with you what we have learned about asking respondents for consent to data linkage, and also about performing other additional tasks. Before we start, we'd like to introduce ourselves. I'm currently working at the Department of Sociology and Social Research at the University of Milano Bicocca. And in the past, I used to work at the Institute for Social and Economic Research in Essex, where I've done quite a lot of work on data linkage together with my colleagues, Kuhn Denise and John Burton. Annette, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Annette Jekyll. I'm a survey methodologist at the University of Essex, former colleague of Emanuela's, and I'm one of the associate directors of the Understanding Society Household Panel study. And I've been doing some work on consent to data linkage, how people make the decision whether or not they're going to let us link their data. And I've also done some work on using mobile apps for data collection. Florian?
Yeah, hi, thanks. My name is Florian Koisch. I'm with the University of Mannheim in Germany at the School of Social Sciences there. My research mainly centers around combining what I would call traditional survey data with new data, new digital data sources. This could include data from smartphones, wearables, other sensors, social media data, and or other types of digital trace data. I've conducted research where we actually try to collect these types of data and we evaluate the quality of the of that data in comparison or in conjunction with survey data. But I also study reasons why people decide to share this type of data with researchers.
Thank you very much, Florian. Right. To start with, I think it would be quite interesting to try and define the concepts that we're using in this talk. So, Florian, would you like to, you know, set the stage and talk us through the different aspects of data linkage, please?
Yeah, sure. So I think before we get started, we should differentiate, I think, two concepts. The one is when we talk about data linkage, what we usually mean, or in the I would say in the traditional original sense, it basically means that we ask respondents as part of a survey for their consent to have their survey data linked to some other type of data that already existed. I would say mostly this is administrative records data, health records, social security data. That's of course nothing brand new, especially not, I would say, in the European context where this has been done for quite a while. But I think this idea of data linkage has gained some traction in the last couple of years, especially because there's just more data available about people. And just think, for example, about social media data. So there's a lot of potential for linkage. The other thing that I think we want to talk about later in this little podcast here is that sometimes we ask people to do additional tasks as part of a survey that go just, I would say, beyond mere data linkage to existing data. That could include, for example, that we ask someone to download a meter to their internet browser that then tracks where people go on the internet, or to download an app to their smartphone that then can be used for taking pictures. Sometimes we ask people to friend a researcher or a research group on Facebook so that the researchers get access to their social media data, or even giving people certain devices such as a fitness tracker, for example, to collect their step counts and physical activity. I'm making this distinction because I think it's important to understand that the latter piece, that asking people for additional tasks, of course, also includes the what I would call linkage in the more narrow sense. So we're linking two types of data. But this additional task that we ask people to do also includes some burden, right? So it's something else that people need to do. And therefore, there might be different mechanisms that play a role if people decide to do data linkage or additional tasks.
Okay, so should we start talking about consent to data linkage? Do Do you want to tell us a bit about the research that you did when you were still at Essex with Gundi Knees and Jonathan Burt, and what you and others were finding at the time about the predictors of consent?
Well, Annette, in the paper with John and Gundi, we wanted to better understand the mechanisms that drove respondents to consent to data linkage. And the focus of our paper was on health and benefit records. And we focused on three main characteristics: interviewer, respondent, and interview features. And I think that we documented, you know, the complexity of a pattern of the association between these characteristics and the propensity to consent. And the key finding, I think, was that the propensity to consent to perform data to data linkage was related, on the one hand, to respondents' attitudes towards privacy, and also on the other hand, on the interviewer task-specific skills. But also, there were some interview features that played a role. We found, for instance, that evidence for stronger household contagion effects. So this actually was suggesting that the decision to consent to data linkage was actually negotiated within the household members and was not an individual decision. And surprisingly, we found that the usual suspects, meaning the social demographic variables, didn't really play a major role. But I wonder, Annette, what actually you found in your research about this?
Yes, you're right. So your study was really interesting, and others at the time. There's a more recent one using the cohort studies in the United Kingdom, where they've also found what you and others have found, that the predictors of consent, if you're looking at characteristics of the respondents and even the interviewers, they're not consistent across different surveys. So I think the trust one, that's maybe one of the few that are consistent. And even when you're looking within longitudinal studies, so you're looking at the same people who've been asked different consents at different points in time, even then the predictors aren't consistent over time. So when we started working on consent, that was one of the things that really puzzled us. You know, it's clearly not observable characteristics. So what is it that does determine whether people consent or not? And there's another really curious finding that has been found in longitudinal studies. So for example, in the health and retirement study, and we've also seen that in our data, in longitudinal studies, if you ask people who say no to a consent question, if you ask them that same question again at a later point in time in a later interview, then half of those people who initially said no, the next time will say yes. So there's a lot of inconsistency over time in people's decisions whether or not to consent. And that suggests that it's not a fixed decision. It's not something that people are really sure about. You know, it's something that it almost feels like a mental coin flip. You know, you're asked, there's a 50-50 chance that you say yes or no. So that was the starting point when we started working on consent. So this is also with Jonathan Burton, with Mick Cooper at the University of Michigan, Sandra Walzenbach, who's now in Konstanz, and Tom Crossley, who's at the European Institute in Florence. And so what we were trying to do was to get inside people's heads and figure out how are people making these decisions, because it's not anything we can observe in the data that we're collecting so far. We need to look more into the decision process. Another striking thing that was known at the time was Marcel Das and Mick Cooper had done a study on consent to data linkage where they asked people knowledge test questions. So they asked for consent, and then afterwards they had a series of true-false statements that the respondents had to answer about the linkage and the resulting data. And that was replicated by Ben Edwards and Nick Biddle as well a bit later. And they found that really most people don't understand the request very well at all, right? So So then the question for us was, well, how are people making this decision and why is it so variable over time? And what can we do to help people make an informed decision and also help them feel comfortable with giving consent? And so we started with some qualitative interviews with some of our sample members to look at how they make this decision, and that then informed our research design for an experimental study. And one of the key things we found there was that really only 30 to 40% of respondents make a systematic decision. So they think through the consequences of what would happen if they said yes to this linkage request. And we've replicated that on several surveys. And that's what we expect people to do, right? We tell them, we give them information leaflets, we give them all this additional information. What we're expecting is that they're thinking through and they're making a rational cost-benefit decision. But it turns out actually only about a third of our respondents do that. Instead, the rest of respondents, what they're doing is they're making decisions based on their gut feeling or based on habit. So it might be based on gut feeling. So on trust, it might be based on how much they trust us, the survey. You know, they've been a respondent in our panel for so many years, nothing bad has ever happened to them, so they consent. Or it might be based on habit. I said what I always say when I'm asked for personal information and I said no. And actually those people, we found a small group of people who make habit-based decisions and they're quite likely to say no, and they say no consistently over time and they're very confident in their decisions. So people who just never give personal information, that you know, they're consistent over time, but for everybody else this is quite a variable decision. And I think we'll come back a bit more to what influences that decision in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, Florian, first, what about other types of tasks? So when we're asking people to use apps or send us other types of information, and I remember a few years ago when we started working on mobile apps, thinking that if we could do passive data collection, so we ask somebody to install an app and that passively tracks their GPS location, for example, right? That really seemed the way to go because it would be low burden for the respondent. I mean, they have to do some things. They have to install this app and everything. But after that, the data collect itself. And then I think it was quite a surprise to find that actually respondents don't like that very much. And we saw that in one of our studies. And I think you had a really nice study that examined and found this as well. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. No, thanks for bringing up that point. And just to, again, reiterate what you just said in terms of this, I think in the literature of the last couple of years, there has been made this distinction now with these new types of data in active and passive data collection. And Mick Cooper once reminded me it's not active and passive data, it's active and passive data collection, right? So the data themselves are not active or passive per se. It's more the perspective of what the respondent or the participant has to do so that data is collected, right? And as you said, this passive forms, right, where it's like you have to do something once, usually download an app, give consent, but then in the background on your phone or on your browser, basically constantly data is collected, right? And then we have more active tasks where you want the respondent to actively do something, right? Take a picture and send it to us, right? Or something else that involves really a task where they are involved in the data collection much more than it runs in the background somewhere. And as I said, I think there was a big hope that this makes it so much easier, right? Because we don't have to constantly ask people. We don't have to ask for consent every time this happens. But maybe not so much surprising. People are a little worried about that, right? So what we see, and we have done a couple of studies, I think Melanie Rivia, together with Mick Cooper, Melanie in Barcelona, Bella Struminskaya in Utrecht and people there, but also Alex Wentz when he was still in Essex, he's now also in Mannheim. So there's a growing body of literature that shows that people are much more concerned about this passive type of data collection, and that people have privacy concerns. They have concerns that they lose control over what data are actually sent to the researcher, right? So if you think about it, on the outside, it might sound very sensitive that a that you send a picture to a researcher, right? There might be so much information in there, and there might be private information and stuff, but you still have a lot of control of what picture you send to the researcher, right? Or even a video. I can curate it. I can take multiple pictures and pick the one that I most like to send to the researcher. Once I download an app and it runs in the background, I give up a certain degree of control over what data is collected. And again, this is very much reflected in that literature in terms of what concerns people have with this type of data. And we see just much lower willingness rates, right? So both in hypothetical, but also in active studies that people say like, oh no, I wouldn't want to share this type of data because there seems to be this privacy risks that are related to that and that loss of control over what data are actually shared. So
yes, Florian, I'm going back to what we were discussing before, you know, the determinants of consent. What do you think are the additional further determinants of consent?
Another consistent evidence is that what many people call digital skills seem to be related, right? So to engage in some of those tasks, you need to be able to download an app to your smartphone, right? And that's very interesting because I think the traditional way of thinking was more a binary kind of like, okay, someone has a smartphone or someone doesn't have a smartphone. So it's more of a coverage issue, right? Whether people would be willing to participate or would even be able to participate in those studies. But we also see that people use their smartphones for very different tasks, for example. So in a number of studies, we have asked people, so among this list of things, what are the things you do on your smartphone? And that could include the basic features that any smartphone or any telephone per se has, doing phone calls, sending text messages. But then you have all these other things you can do with a smartphone, right? So browsing the internet, doing online shopping, going on social media, taking pictures and these type of things. And what we have seen is that the more things people report that they're doing on a smartphone, and we take this as a measure of how comfortable, how skilled people are with the technology, the more likely then they are also to engage in these additional tasks when it comes to smartphones, right? So I think this is, we're moving more towards what's now called the second level digital divide. It's not so much of who has a smartphone and who doesn't have a smartphone. So I think that we need some more research on that that goes beyond just social demographic differences. Because even among young people, we see that there is some people who use the smartphone literally just for phone calls and taking pictures, but not much else, right? I mean, again, with older adults, I think there's a higher likelihood that we also see lower digital skills, but there's also very digitally skilled, I would say, older people who use their smartphone a lot. And that seems to be actually a stronger driver than just a mere social demographics that we usually use, right? And so I think that also needs us to think about the types of data we collect with that and whether we probably shouldn't only worry about social demographics when it comes to the differences then between people who participate and do not participate, right? So for example, in I already mentioned the IAB Smart study, we found that people who are more active on social media are also then more likely to download an app that tracks their behavior on the smartphone. So if you would then use that to estimate how actively people are using social media, you're overestimating the amount of social media use on smartphones because you get the people who are more likely, who are more active to be on the smartphone. In another study we look at is smartphone use related to physical activity, for example. And we also found that there's a good share of people who leave their smartphone at home when they go outside, for example, right? So that also means once you want to start collecting information about mobility or physical activity and want to use the smartphone for that, you're not going to probably cover all the physical activity that people are engaging in outside of home, because there's a good share of people who don't bring their smartphone with them wherever they go, right? So I think that's the type of research we need to be going forward to better understand what we can actually learn from these new types of data. And I know that Annette, you also were involved in or are involved in studies in the UK using the innovation panel. And I think you have looked into financial behaviors of people and what that is related to then if you want to measure or want to use the smartphone to measure financial behavior.
So your point about the first and the second level digital divide, obviously that's really right. And one thing we learned that we didn't know beforehand in one of our mobile app studies was we looked at biases in who did and did not have a compatible phone. In this case, this was Android or iPhones were compatible. And of course, we already lose part of the sample because they don't have one of those smartphones. And then we looked at among the people who did had a phone, who then actually downloaded and used the app and, you know, an overall sort of, you know, the participants compared to the full sample. And the curious thing was that in the variables that we looked at, the biases due to coverage, people not having a device, and then participation conditional on having a device, they all went in the same direction. So they were reinforcing so each other, you know. We didn't know a priority, they could have cancelled each other out, but it wasn't the case. Then a second point, so you've mentioned how intensely people use their smartphones, the number of different types of things they do on their smartphones as a predictor of whether or not they participate. And I think it's more specific than that also. So in one study, we looked at predictors of who participated in our mobile app study. And like you were just suggesting, we looked at social demographics. And it's what you'd expect. We're underrepresenting the older, the less educated, and so on. But we then also looked at people's behaviors, both related to the content that we wanted to measure. So the first app studies that we did were about measuring people's spending. So did they keep a budget? How often did they check their accounts? Those kind of things. But then also behaviors on their smartphone. Did they use an app to check their balances? Did they use mobile banking and things like that? And there we found that whether or not people already did similar types of things on their smartphones before we asked them to do this study for us, that was really very predictive of whether or not they participated. But then the curious thing was that in the third step, we also looked at the outcomes. So what it was we were measuring, right? We were measuring spending. So people had to report their spending for a month. And we were able to, in the survey data that we had for everybody, so those who participated in the mobile app study and those who did not, we had expenditure information there as well. So we were able to look at spending according to the survey and how that differed between the app users and those who didn't participate. And curiously there, we did not find any differences. So that's just reinforcing what you've just said, Florian, that as we know, with all non-response and non-response bias research, it's not enough to just look at social demographic correlates. But really, ideally, we need to set up studies so that we can test for biases in what it is that we're measuring.
Okay, given all this, what do you know about how the survey design influences whether people consent or perform these additional tasks, Annette?
Okay, so should we start with consent to data linkage? So here, the most important survey design aspect that has a massive influence is the mode of data collection. And we've seen that in a study by Joe Saxor and also a study by Lisa Calderwood and colleagues on the cohort studies in the UK, that with self-completion surveys, you get much lower consent rates than with interviewer administered surveys. And we've replicated that in Understanding Society as well. And we get a 30 percentage point lower consent rate when people answer online than when they're answering that same question with an interviewer. And we've been able to identify that this really is a causal effect of the mode on people's willingness to consent. It's not a selection effect. So it's not because different types of people are completing the survey online and face to face. And so we also see that when people are answering the consent question online, they're answering more quickly, they're less likely to read additional information material, and they're less likely to process the question systematically. They're more likely to make habit-based decisions. So we can see that people just deal with this question differently when they're completing this online. We can also, when we ask knowledge test questions, see that they're understanding the request less well. So then what can we do? So one hypothesis, obviously, is that it's the interviewers offering additional explanations, supporting somehow this consent decision, but we don't see that. So when we listen to audio recordings of the face-to-face interviews, we hear that respondents very rarely ask questions and interviewers only very rarely offer any additional explanation. And actually, Emmanuel, I'm just remembering one of your studies as well. You did behavior coding, didn't you, as well, of consent questions?
Yes, we did that with Noah and Ned.
And I think you found that actually, if people asked a question, it was because they're about to say no to the linkage. So asking question, getting more information didn't help support.
Yeah, that's right, Annette. Yeah, you remember well, Annette.
Okay, it also seems to be the case, I think this is something that Florian alluded to earlier, that people seem to be more concerned about their privacy and about the security of their data when they're completing a survey online than when they're completing it face-to-face. In the qualitative interviews, we had people say that, you know, online, they had no idea where their data was going. They were just, you know, putting their answers out on the web. Whereas with the interviewer, they could see it was going in the interviewer's laptop. You know, they felt more secure. Okay, so that's the first survey design aspect that has a really big impact, the mode in which we ask this consent question. We also know that providing additional information about the linkage does not help. So I've already mentioned this, the web respondents, they're very unlikely to read additional information materials. Even in the face-to-face survey where the interviewer hands over the leaflet and says, please read this, not everybody actually reads it. And we experimentally found that even when we did manage to increase people's understanding of the request by varying, you know, how we asked the question, that didn't increase consent rates. So there's a correlation between understanding and giving consent. People who have better understanding are more likely to consent, but that doesn't seem to be causal. So I'm saying this because when we're thinking about survey design, what can we do to support informed consent? Just giving more information does not help. Then when asking for multiple consents, so sometimes in one survey, you might ask for consent to link to health data, to tax records, to education data, you know, all in one interview. So there's the question, how do you do that? And we found experimentally that the format doesn't really matter, you know, whether you present this as a sequence of individual questions or whether you present them all on one page, that doesn't affect consent rates. And we've had some inconsistent findings. So when we asked with consent questions where we tend to get higher consents, that tended to increase consent for some of the following questions as well. So we tend to get higher consent rates for education linkage, for example, and people don't like linking financial data. So we get lower consent rates for tax records and benefits data. So if we start with the education or health, also we get higher consent rates. That helps, but our findings haven't been entirely consistent. And I think, Florian, you've done some.
Yeah, so sorry to interrupt you. This is on purpose. As you said, there's not that much research out there yet on the order. But from what we have seen, so we have done a study where we provided people with different vignettes of hypothetical studies, right? And we consistently see that the first vignette created higher willingness, regardless of what the characteristics were in that specific vignette. So the first consent request was more likely to create willingness than the ones that followed. And we did another study with colleagues at Gazes, where we also randomly varied what type of data we asked people to consent to sharing. And as you said before, there is quite some variation in that. There's a strong driver of what that data is, right? So health data is people have more concern, they're less willing to share this, and bank data especially, right, than maybe social media data. But again, we randomly varied this and we find a clear declining willingness to share data the more questions you ask, right? Regardless of what that question is. Of course, again, it depends on what level you start with based on what type of data you ask for. So you could take from that is like, okay, if you really want to have specific types of data and you're worried that people, you already are working from a very low, probably baseline rate that people are willing to give it, then you have to ask that first, because otherwise you're going to lose even more people on that, right? But I think there's more research that needs to go in there, especially as you said in this interaction, right? Like, what's the right order to ask that? Does it make sense to really ask the very sensitive one first, and what effect does this have on other questions? So I think there's more research to do this. And again, I think this ties nicely back to what Annette you said earlier, that there seems to be some variability in how people make this consent decision that is driven more by these type of context effects, as we know them also from surveys, I think, than really a strong latent attitude that people have about these things that are really consistent across time.
That is so interesting that you say that. And actually, I hadn't planned to mention this, but I will. So there are three papers that exactly speak to what you've just said. So the importance of context effects versus a latent willingness to consent. So the first paper in this series was one that Stephen Jenkins first authored, and that Emmanuel and I were involved in. This is a while ago. This was a study where we asked for two or three different consents for linkage within one survey. And what Stephen did in this paper was jointly model the probability of giving consent across these different consents, and then using a joint model that allowed the unobservables in these models to be correlated or not. so you could test. And that suggested that there was such a correlation in observables. So there were characteristics that we were not measuring that were determinant consent consistently across these three different consent questions. So that led to the interpretation that we thought, okay, there seems to be some latent willingness to consent or not consent. And then there was a similar paper by Tariq Mostafa, I think, using one of the cohorts, maybe the Millennium Cohort Study, I don't remember, in the UK. That found a similar result, that also found this correlation of unobservables across consents. But then he did another paper with a colleague, Wiggins, where they did the same kind of modeling, but using data collected at different points in time. So it's a longitudinal study, it's the same people, and they were asked consents at different points in time in the study. And there, the really interesting thing is that these unobservables are no longer highly correlated. It's much weaker. So this suggests that there are situational factors that within one sitting, within one interview, influence whether you're willing or not to consent in this interview. But it's not a stable characteristic. It's not a stable trait that respondents carry with them. At the next interview, the situation is going to be different, and the influencing factors are going to be different, and the decision can be different. Yes, so now I've lost what I was actually going to say, but I'm glad you brought that up, because that was also one of the things that we were grappling with when we were starting to think about how are people making this decision, so the importance of these situational factors. And then related to that, so the question at the moment I'm trying to answer at the moment is, what survey design features matter? What influences whether people give consent or not? And I also wanted to point out that actually this is curious in this field of research, that there are quite a few studies with experimenting with different ways of wording the consent request. And there are many, many that have just had null findings or inconsistent findings. So, so Joe Saxor has done a few studies where he's used loss framing. So emphasizing to the respondent that if they don't consent, then everything else they've already told you is of less use. And I think initially he replicated in several studies that increased consent, as opposed to not saying anything or using gain framing, so emphasizing the value. But I think in multiple studies, or that hasn't always replicated now. There were other studies, I think also by the Census Bureau in the US, Joanne Pascal maybe, and others, that have emphasized the benefit to the respondent. So if you consent, then the survey is going to be shorter, or that have emphasized the benefits, for the data, the quality of the data, or, it might be less error it might be cheaper, you know, savings in terms of tax money, and they've not found any effects. One thing we did that did have an effect was emphasizing trust. And I think that's something that you've mentioned already before, Florian. So that is important. So trust in the organizations involved. So that might be something that's something to work on more. How do we legitimately establish trust in the organizations involved to try and support informed consent? And then the last aspect I wanted to mention is where in the questionnaire we ask for consent. And I want to say more about that, but I wanted to ask you, Emanuela, I think you maybe did the first experiment varying the placement of the consent question in the questionnaire. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yes, Annette, that's right. That's what we've done with Gundi, Nisa, and John Burton. And that was actually part of our research agenda that we developed at that time. And it follows on from what we have been doing before, meaning, you know, looking at the determinants of consent. So in this paper, actually, we focused on you know, the manipulation of the question characteristics. So we designed three experiments, and we were quite lucky because we could implement these experiments on the data of the innovation panel of Understanding Society, right? So fully exploiting the potential of the longitudinal context. So we prefer three different experiments. First one, we actually changed the placement of a consent question. The second experiment, we actually modified the wording of a consent question. And in the third experiment, we played around with the time in the life of the panel in which to ask the consent question. And I think that we actually shown the relevance of the survey features of the question. So we found, for instance, that when the consent question was asked in content, meaning after a set of questions regarding income benefit, for instance, then the likelihood to agree to the consent question was higher. There was a 7-point percentage difference between those who were administered the question at the end of the relevant section compared to those who were asked the question at the end of the questionnaire. But also, we found that when we administered the DI question compared to the independent question, we got a striking difference of 25%, a percentage point difference between those who were administered the DI question and those who were administered the independent question. And also we found some evidence. Yes, Annette, sorry.
Maybe just explain what the DI question was.
Yeah. The DI question is called dependent interviewing. So it's a way of, you know, asking question that draws on previous answers that are provided by respondents, especially in a longitudinal setting when we can actually fit forward the information that we get. And yes, I was just wanted to finish off by saying that we also found that when the consent question is asked later in the life of the panel, we found some preliminary evidence showing that the consent rates were higher. So definitely, you know, these features played a key role in indirectly having respondents to consent to later linkage.
Yeah, this was that was so interesting because clearly, you know, we're talking about this variability in the consent decision, but when we remind people of what, like you did in your study, of what they said last time, then they're quite consistent and they say the same thing again. But I wanted to say a bit more about the varying where in the questionnaire we ask. So you found this higher consent rate when you asked a bit earlier in the questionnaire and in context. So that confounded two things. It was earlier in the questionnaire and it was also in context. And I think Joe Saxor also has an experimental study where he found higher consent rates when it was asked earlier. And we've also replicated this on two studies now. And initially we thought that our hypothesis was that by the end of the questionnaire, you know, our survey takes on average 40 minutes, longer if you're the household reference person and you've also completed the household grid and the household questionnaire. So by the end, people are tired. So we thought maybe this is cognitive depletion. And by the end, people aren't making the effort to understand this. And so if in doubt, they're saying no. But we didn't see that. So we had these test questions where we asked people these true or false questions about the linkage to test their understanding. And we actually surprisingly saw no difference in how well people understood the request, regardless of whether they were asked early or late. So we didn't find support for this hypothesis, you know, that at the end they're tired, they're not understanding, so they're saying no. Instead, what we've done in another follow-up study now, where we had a very large sample, so we had a treatment very early in the survey, a bit later, but in context, and at the end, we then added some follow-up questions asking why they didn't consent. And this was a multiple choice question. So this was kind of to look at the hypotheses. We gave them different options. And the interesting thing was that when we asked late, so not only did more people not consent, but also more of the non-consenters said it was because they felt they'd already done enough, they'd already told us enough information. So this to us looks as though it's something that we're labeling giving fatigue. So by the end of the survey, people just think, I've already told you enough about me, you don't need this as well. And actually, this is something that we've seen in a mobile app study as well that we did, where we also varied where in the survey we asked people to download and start using this app. And we see the same thing, that actually we get much higher participation when we ask people earlier during the survey to download the app and participate in the study than when we ask at the end. There we didn't have these follow-up questions, but so this is a hypothesis at the moment that this really is some form of giving fatigue, that people just think they've already told us enough about themselves.
Okay, so far we discussed about, you know, data linkage, but what about other type of tasks? Florian, what do we know about, you know, how the survey design influences respondent willingness to perform these additional tasks?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Annette, you mentioned a couple of things already here, and we have mentioned before, for example, things such as that willingness seems to be really driven by the type of data that is collected. But as a researcher, we have relatively little control, or it's not a design feature that I can deliberately change that much, right? I mean, if I want to collect picture data, because there's certain information in there, I cannot, instead of that, asking people to give GPS data or the other way around, right? So we're definitely limited in that perspective. What we see, and maybe there's a little bit more control on the researcher side, is that, and again, that's something we have seen in survey research before, is that it really differs who asks for that data, right? So we see that people are more likely to share data in a university research context, right? So if you can use a university, or if you collaborate with a university, it seems to help. That it seems that people are more trusting in these organizations compared to commercial market researchers, for example. But in Germany also, in terms of compared to government-related organizations, again, this might vary depending on where you're doing your research, because I think the trust that is brought towards these different organizations might again vary on the context. Again, there's not that much you can do. I mean, also related to that, we find that people who have been in studies longer, and I think Annette, you also mentioned this before, in our IB Smart study, we recruited people out of an existing longitudinal panel, and the people who had been members of that panel were much more likely, were more likely to also then additionally download an app. So again, we interpret this a lot that this has to do with I have experience with this organization. I can trust them. They're not going to sell my data and these type of things. Of course, there's only so much you can do in terms of creating this trust. Maybe we need more, and I think we need more research and kind of like what we can actively to build up trust in the data collecting organizations. One thing that we definitely can is under control of the researcher seems to be incentives, right? And again, there's so much literature on incentives in surveys, so this is not surprising. I would say in terms of what we have seen so far, and again, this is only a growing field, I feel, and there's not that many studies out there that really experimentally varied that. But what we have seen both from when we ask for hypothetical willingness, so if we just say like, okay, imagine you're invited to participate in the study, would you be willing to participate? We see that it seems to make a clear difference whether you provide an incentive or not provide an incentive, right? So people seem to expect almost in a way that this additional work that they're putting into, and for good reasons, I would say, that they also get an additional incentive, especially if you already incentivized them probably for the survey in the first place, right? So making them additional burden, additional work seems to be that people are expecting something in return, and that might be an incentive. What we also found, and again, this is not only our study, but I think others have also seen that the amount of incentive then, if you were, that doesn't really play that big of a role, both in asking hypothetical, but also in terms of once people are in the study and you probably don't need to go overboard. So in the IAB Smart study, we experimented with the amount that we provided to people if they were in the study and they stayed in the study. That didn't make much of a difference, right? We also experimented with providing to making people participate in many or provide as much data as possible. So for example, we varied whether people got a bonus incentive if they completed all the tasks we asked them to do, and that bonus incentive didn't help, for example. So there is a limit, it seems, to what you can actually do with incentives, right? And I think, again, that there's lots of research in the survey context, and I think there we need to learn more about that in that additional task context as well. The other thing that we have seen is that it seems to also depend on how long you ask, and again, that relates to burden probably, how long you ask people to be part of that study and how long you ask them to provide additional data, for example. So we see that the longer your data collection period is, so we varied this a little bit and say, okay, if the study only runs a month versus it runs for 3 months, right? And we see different willingness there. But with many of these features that I think we could vary, the literature, the findings are very sparse yet, right? There's this one study that looks at that. There is another study that looks at this feature. I think Anne Elveld in Utrecht just defended her dissertation a couple of months ago, and I think she has a nice overview paper of the literature that has been, that is in that context, is collected in that context. But I think the conclusion also is that we need to learn more. There's no, we don't have that body of literature yet where we can clearly say these are the design features where you can turn the knob and it will help you increase willingness compared to others, right?
Yes, so I agree with you. There are some design features that with our experience in traditional surveys, you know, we know incentives can make a really big difference to get people to complete a normal survey. But it's also been our experience that in these app studies, they don't help as much. I think like you, we assume that our participants expect a reward, some incentive. So we've done two experiments with incentives, but we've never had a control group where we don't offer anything because we don't think that's right, because we're, like you said, we're incentivizing them for the annual interview as well. So if we ask them to do something more, we need to incentivize them in some way. But we've experimented with the amounts, like you were saying, of incentives. In one study, we offered them an incentive just for downloading the app, plus then incentives for daily use and for, you know, for doing the full period. And that difference in how much we offered just for downloading the app, that had no effect. And then in a study last year, we've varied experimentally whether or not they get a bonus if they complete every day. This was a 14-day study. And there we did have a control group that just got an incentive for every day on which they used the app, but they got no additional bonus. And then two other groups that got a bonus that was implemented in different ways of £10, so not a negligible amount, but that also has no effect. So I think you're right. The mechanisms, you know, it's not the same as a normal survey to try and persuade people to participate. And then you're finding about the burden and the length of time, the period of data collection. That's really interesting. We have in our study last year with a mobile app, we experimentally varied how long the task was every day. So as I said, it was a 14-day data collection period. They had to use this app every day to report on their well-being and experiences during the day. And for one group, this was just 2 minutes every day. And for the other group, it was 10 minutes every day. So if you sum that up over the 14 days, that was quite a big difference in the amount of time that we were asking them to spend. And we told them that up front when we asked them to download the app. And that had no effect at all. We were surprised by that. So this is a different aspect of burden. It's, you know, how burdensome is the daily task? That as opposed to your, you know, burden over time, what's the length of time? But yeah, it's just confirming what you're saying, adding to that, that we don't know very much about these determinants yet. We need to keep working to understand better how the survey design influences what people are willing to do.
Yes, thanks, Annette, and thanks, Florin. But we are nearly about to finish our podcast. Well, I think it would be interesting to know what you are working on at the moment, Florian.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I think I threw in already a couple of things that I'm really excited about along those lines of research that we have, among others, the second level digital divide understanding differences there. One other thing that I think I haven't really mentioned specifically, but in the past, we have thought of survey participation in a very binary way, right? Someone participates or someone doesn't participate, right? Someone consents or doesn't consent. And now we have all these studies that are all of a sudden blown up in terms of complexity, right? You have a survey that might be longitudinal, right? So you have this longitudinal component. Then in between, you might ask people to do something additionally, right? To download an app. Then you might ask people to consent to record linkage, right? And it makes it just also logistically, I think, both more complicated, but also in terms of understanding, again, coming back to what we just talked about, understanding mechanisms, right? And I think we need to start, I don't know, clearing the dust off a little bit from all our first exploratory studies and trying to, I don't know what to say, that maybe it's harmonizing, but maybe finding better terminology in terms of the different steps that people go through, right, when they participate in those studies. So we have talked about hypothetical willingness, right? So someone says they're willing to participate. Well, we also see that then people drop off when they are actually supposed to provide that data, right? And there's different mechanisms that play a role at these different stages, right? So to better understand this and to understand what happens at different stages across a very potentially very complex study, right? And I'm thinking about how do we calculate response rates or participation rates in the future, right? So you have a study that has a survey component, right? But then it has other components. So the same person might be a participant in one piece of the study, but a non-participant in the other piece of the study. So how do we report this, right? How do we report this in our methods reports? Maybe this is overambitious, but I'm thinking about something along the lines of maybe the APOR standards, right? Where we give clear names to certain categories of behavior within such a study, right? Which I think could also help us a little bit in then again, develop better studies and also, and I think this is the other thing, compare effects across studies. That's what I'm sometimes really struggling with, right? I see all these great studies, but it's so hard to compare them, both in terms of their designs, but also in terms of their outcomes, right? Because it seems like depending on so many factors, people use different outcomes to compare studies with each other. And maybe, as I said, maybe that's overambitious and we might never get there, but my goal would be to to move in that direction a little bit, that that would be a call that that hopefully some people will pick up, right? And I'm happy to contribute to the, to this as well.
That's a very rich research agenda, Florian. And what about you, Annette?
So we're starting to think about how all this fits together. So in a survey, Understanding Society, where we've got the annual questionnaires, we also occasionally collect biomeasures. We're trying to do event-triggered data collection, where we check in with respondents every month and see, you know, whether they've experienced any big life events so that we can ask about that close in time to when it happened. We've been doing this development work on mobile apps. We ask for consent to link to all sorts of different types of data. So we've got all these different ways in which we're trying to collect and combine data about our sample members. And so, yeah, so we've been working on these in isolation, I think, so far. And so now we're starting to think a bit more across these different things. What determines whether people will do these? And what are the barriers? And what can we do in terms of survey design to help people feel comfortable with participating in these things? You know, in the end, our goal is always to make sure that the data we collect are useful in terms of sample size, response rates, and biases, of course. So, right. So in thinking about these different types of tasks, so it's likely that there'll be some common determinants. So we've mentioned privacy, data security concerns, those kind of things. Obviously, topic interest, engagement with the study, you know, maybe if they've been a member of the panel longer, those kind of things. Their trust in the study. And we've seen some things that maybe are effective in for some of these tasks, but not others, like the incentives, for example. They seem to be less effective, so there seem to be other barriers. So with the record linkage, the sensors, these additional tasks, of course, there are all these other things, right, that we've mentioned. So respondents have less control over the data that's being collected. It's possibly also more difficult for us to explain well what we're actually collecting and how those data will be used. And it's potentially also more risky. So if, you know, we link tax data and that somehow gets leaked, or somebody leaves a laptop on a train, as has happened in the past in this country, you know, that might be more risky for the respondent than if we've just got the data that they've told us, you know, the information they've told us in the survey, in the questionnaire, in the interview. So it's really, we're working towards understanding what the barriers are. So nobody's going to participate in all these tasks. But why? What are the barriers? So is it because we're asking too much? We're asking too much time? We're asking too much effort, right? With these mobile app studies, people need to know where to go to find an app. They need to know how to install it. They need to figure out how to use this app. That's all additional. It's not just time, it's also effort. Or are we just asking too much information about the respondent, you know, that they feel, okay, I've already told you all this, really, I don't see why you need all this in addition, that just feels like it's too much. So is it those type of concerns that we're asking too much? Or is it because of the possible risks that people maybe don't feel they understand quite so well why we're asking for these additional things, and they're not quite sure how we'll keep their data safe, you know, those kind of things. That's another possibility. And I think we don't know that at the moment. So I'm sort of trying to work towards thinking about understanding why, what are the barriers in these different settings, maybe what's a common thread, how are different things, you know, some of the tasks different, and always, of course, trying to figure out, well, what can we do in terms of survey design to support people in giving informed consent and to participating in these additional studies. And so I think that requires some theoretical thinking. We've found qualitative work really, really helpful. I mentioned that in the context of the consent work. We also did some qualitative work to help with the design of some of our apps. So actually going and talking to some of our sample members to explore before we then design experimental quantitative studies to test hypotheses. So thinking broader across these different types of tasks, rather than just thinking about each of them in isolation. I think that's what we're trying to work towards at the moment. Well, Emanuela, Florian, it's been Really nice to see you, at least in this way, even if not in person. And I hope to see you for real soon.
I hope to see you in 2 years' time here at the next Ezra, which is supposed to be in Milano.
Yeah,
You're
hopefully
welcome.
not, if not earlier, right? So,
Yeah,
thank you,
definitely.
Emanuele, and it was a pleasure. And I hope everybody also enjoyed it as much as we did. And thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Yes, I think we reached the end of our podcast, and thanks for listening. Bye. Bye bye.
Bye.